Hello there, and welcome to the PC Gamer Show for Wednesday, October 4th, 2017. I'm Evan Lottie, Editor-in-Chief. Glad to be here with Tim Clark and Wesley Fenlon. How's it going, guys?
Doing well for me. I'm flanked by authority on both sides.
Be careful. We're watching you, Wes.
So, not too bad. Thanks, Evan. Pleasure to be on.
Yeah, great to have you back on, Tim. I know it's been a little bit.
It's been a while. It's been a minute.
It has. So, yeah, some good stuff to talk about today. You know, as we've been discussing over the past week, it's that time of year where a lot of interesting games are coming out every week. So new stuff for us to talk about. We'll be going over Cuphead, a recent high difficulty platformer in the style of old cartoons. Really interesting, unique concept. Tim's going to tell us about his XCOM 2 run here in a second. And finally have somebody on the show to authoritatively talk about Divinity 2, one of the biggest games of the year. It seems like it's going to turn out
to
be.
Yeah, I think it's already sold over 500,000 copies on PC, maybe 750,000, something like that, which I think is amazing for an isometric hardcore CRPG. And I've been playing it three-player co-op the past couple of weeks, so I'm excited to talk about that. I've got some good stories.
Does that mean you can only play when your other two friends are on?
Yes, and they're on the East Coast, which gives us, during the week, about a two-hour window. But we've been making it work. So
that seems intensely frustrating to me with a game like that. I'd want to keep going.
It's been okay. It's fun. Okay. You get some good shenanigans, so.
Nice. All right. Looking forward to hearing about that. So there's been some interesting conversation about game difficulty and accessibility on Twitter and some other people writing about this that we want to dig into a little bit today. So that will be one of our main topics as well. And as always, we'll be taking your questions at the end of the show. So get them ready. Put them in Twitch chat as we look to conclude in about an hour. So we'll see you guys there. All right. So tell me about what you guys have been playing. Tim, start over there.
Yeah, so I'm nearing the end of my War of the Chosen campaign run through. I don't want to talk about the difficulty level I'm playing on. Maybe that will come up in the later discussion.
Oh, whatever.
I'm relatively new to strategy games, although I did play XCOM 2 completely through when it came out. You don't want a potted review necessarily, but like War of the Chosen for me has been like, I don't want to say it's like it feels like the game XCOM 2 should have been, because I think XCOM 2 was good when it came out, bar some technical hitches. But what it does feel like is this unbelievably complete package to me. I think I was reading like Tom Francis talking, who's ex-PCG, also just released his most recent game,
Heat Signature.
He was talking about how he felt like each time they add a new system in, they should be forced to take one out, because it is full of new layers and systems to kind of tinker with. Like, yeah. I said to you, Evan, like I hadn't realized even halfway through my run, like how you acquired those bonus abilities for the soldiers, because they were generated in different ways. Previously, they just kind of popped up, but now you have to kind of like train them out using your ability points.
Yep.
But yeah, so this week I killed the third and final chosen, and I feel like a genuine sense of loss that those guys aren't there kind of baiting me on the menu screens anymore. There was an actual sense of sadness as I flew back to the base. Oh, and man. I just had the speaker talking to me, doing his like XCOM's missions have been, you know, they're evil terrorists, and like I'm like, I imagine you
like calling the chosen on your cell phone,
guys,
actually on your rotary guys. Phone, it's more dramatic, and like it's just ringing and ringing, and it goes to voicemail.
Yeah, like yeah. Or the inbox is full because all my soldiers are phoning him to bait them.
I want to know who got the final kill.
The final one.
Tell us about your crew, Tim. I mean, this is relevant too.
Yeah. So I model all my. I don't do friends and families. I know a lot of people do. I model them after like actors and actresses. But my original spec was they had to be slightly faded. They couldn't be like superstars. They were kind of like character actors and like. Maybe they're a little bit on the sort of downwards curve. So like Jean Reno is one of my best soldiers. He's a specialist. He's like he's using the disruptor rifle, which you get from one of the chosen kills. You can research afterwards. So Jean Reno had like missed every single shot on the final mission, like to the point where I was absolutely pulling what little hair I've got out.
Using a good weapon, right?
Like this was before he got the disruptor rifle, actually. But yeah, he was on Overwatch when the chosen guy. Came back for his final stand after he'd been, because they were surprised they come back. And he just nailed this unbelievable crit shot for like 15 damage.
Oh,
like,
man.
Yeah, it was like crazy. And he honestly couldn't hit like the proverbial cow's ass with a banjo before. My best guys are like Tom Hardy, who's a sharpshooter. He's very good with the fanfire. He's got AP rounds on his pistol. Really into like the covert actions, and like because you can get like ability buffs from sending them on specific missions. So like picking the right people to go. Alison Brie got kidnapped, had to put in a lot of effort to get her back, but obviously couldn't leave Brie MIA.
And you have Naomi Watts as well.
Naomi Watts was killed on a mission.
Jesus,
with
Tim.
Yeah, with Colin Farrell and Naomi Watts. They were ambushed on one of the covert ops. Only John Malkovich made it out alive. And Malkovich was a key member of the squad. And Naomi Watts had been good, but she's been replaced by Jared Leto. I don't know why I called him Jared Leto, because I don't like Jared Leto. Most of the other ones are ones I like. Like, half the cast of Sense8 is in there, because I needed basically a lot of actors and actresses because of the inevitable churn of combat missions.
And yet Jared Leto has frustratingly survived.
Yeah, he's doing okay.
He's like a Templar or something, right?
He's a Templar, yeah. Probably, other than other than Tom Hardy, my best one is Hugh Jackman, though. And Hugh Jackman is wearing the berserker suit you can research. So he's got like a Wolverine kind of vibe. He's also got like the katana and the shotgun you get from killing the assassin, I think, chosen. But yeah, so I'm in this weird, because we wrote actually about not finishing games recently on the site, and I'm almost the opposite of this, where I'm trying to prolong doing the final few handful of missions where you go off with the avatar and stuff, because I want to track down the last of the bosses that was added in. It's not really a boss, but special alien from the Alien Hunters DLC. I found two of them, but I think like they just pop up on facility missions and stuff, and I can't seem to find the last one, which is the Archon. I never say that right.
Yeah. The guy that's all torso. He's like a very Egyptian looking robot android torso.
They seem like the least effective of almost all the enemy's units. Like, you shoot them, they do that hover thing, then they do the kind of AOE thing, but you can usually avoid it.
I mean, once you get the Blade Master ability, the Stun Lancers, you can just destroy in most situations.
They do not like the sweet kiss of Cold Steel Evan, let me tell you.
and also the, what do they call it? The giant, like, yogurt monsters.
Oh, the faceless.
Yeah,
I'm trying to follow along with this, having only played XCOM 1. I never got around to base XCOM 2 or the expansion, and like, none of this sounds remotely like it existed in the first game.
The aliens have done some very creative things with yogurt now, Wes.
I want Hugh Jackman with a katana. That's way cooler than my laser rifles from the first game.
A katana that can't miss.
Is it 100%?
That's even better.
It's not even 100%. It's binary. It just can't miss.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Great.
Good stuff. Well, so
I did the same thing as you, prolonging the game when I played The Witcher 3, which I know you loved as well. And I played probably like 60 or 70 hours of it in the first maybe like 2 months, 3 months after it came out. And then I stopped playing it for many, many months. And then I finally went back, and instead of just beating the game, I was like in kind of the last stretch of story missions, I went around getting the wolf gear armor for Geralt. Because I like looked up all the armor and was like, this is the coolest looking armor.
It's the master armor.
And it was the one that I wanted for like all the cutscenes. Because whatever you wear in battle is what he's going to have in the cutscene. So I spent like 8 hours tracking down every bit of Witcher gear, high level armor, just so that I could have my pick of it at the end of the game.
Whereas I'm not saying I got every set of master armor, but I did get every set of master armor.
I think I got almost all of them. I got at least a few.
Did you finish Blood and Wine in the end?
No, I still haven't gone back to the expansion.
What?
I didn't start Blood and Wine, I still have it all before me.
You can get a set of armor in Blood and Wine that looks exactly like Dracula's armor in the start of Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, that kind of red, almost muscular.
I'm into that.
Yeah, I watched Dracula in 4K just the other week.
Hey, have we published our story about Geralt?
If not yet, then any minute.
Oh yes, we have. Let me put this up here while we're talking about Geralt.
We just put up a feature by written by Geralt of Rivia on our site about his retirement running a winery. This is hard hitting fan fiction from Geralt. I guess it wouldn't be fan fiction if it's from, it's just fiction.
It's autobiography. I like.
So it's a game called Terroir. Right, about running a winery, right?
It's an indie wine sim, but we decided it would be more fun if we imagined Geralt as the owner of this winery. So.
And naturally, we took the opportunity to
put him in a tub.
Do that.
Of wine.
Do that. Anyway, I just wanted to make sure because I'm excited to read this. I haven't even read it yet. Anyway.
Yeah, it's a really fun piece.
The game looks nice. I like the style.
Tim, looking forward to you completing the XCOM run. I know it's I was the same way. I wanted to keep going. I wanted to keep grinding and make sure I had the abilities and the kind of composition of characters I wanted. And then, like, in the end, I put people on a covert mission, and then I accidentally triggered the last sequence. I couldn't bring them into the final mission. Honestly, like, kind of added a little bit of drama.
And you were playing Iron Man, of course, so
yeah,
no going back.
And I definitely lost two people on the final mission too.
Wow,
but it's cool.
Did you make a poster?
You know, I don't know if you can make a poster post final mission.
Well, that seems like an oversight.
I guess you could just go into the tool and do it, but I should have. Anywho, I've been playing a weird selection of stuff. I'm sort of in this weird stage at home over the past week where I can't decide.
I've seen you booting up Pac-Man 256 a few times. I was like, that's interesting. That's not the game I would expect Evan to be playing. There are no guns in Pac-Man 256.
Sort of polite of you. I don't know. I was just, for one thing, it's sort of called into light like how poor Steam is at recommending stuff, in my opinion. Mm. And this is coming from someone who has access to every game on Steam. I have a Steam Press account, so I can just jump into whatever, and I still experience this paralysis to like a weird degree.
That probably makes it worse.
Yeah, probably.
You have a selection of 15,000 games or something,
and I have fiber now. I promise I'm not like bragging at this point, but I can just like get stuff really quickly. Anywho, so yeah, Pac-Man 256. I'm not even really a big Pac-Man fan, but it intrigued me. Initially, I thought this was the other Pac-Man game that came out a few years ago.
Championship Edition.
Yeah. Like DX or something. Yeah. Which I liked, and I just sort of conflated the two. Anyway, this is sort of like a roguelike Pac-Man.
It's like weird. An endless runnery kind of thing, almost. Just keeps going and going, and then you get as far as you can, right?
That's a better way of putting it, but there's this, sort of this persistent upgrade or power-up system where you control the three power-ups that spawn in the map, right? So you can have, and there's like a variety of ones where like, there's like a laser that shoots out of Pac-Man and just destroys any ghosts in his path.
Is it still top down and he's eating pills, or is it a 3D thing?
It's top down, but isometric. So it's slightly askew. Anyway, there's these different power-ups, and you can upgrade the power-ups to increase their duration. You're unlocking more of those power-ups to add your kind of toolbox over time. And anytime you hit 256 dots eaten consecutively with no interruption, because there are little gaps in the map where there are no dots, or obviously you could like, if you turn backward over yourself, you stop eating dots because you clear the ones behind you. Anyway, if you eat 256 consecutively, it clears the board, and it's like this tremendous feeling of chaining it together, of dodging ghosts and like optimizing your path and stuff like that. And I don't know, I've just really enjoyed the casual fun of sitting there with a controller.
Something else while you're playing Pac-Man? Like, do you have like a podcast on it? Because I feel like I couldn't just play a game like Pac-Man for anything more than like half an hour.
It's not just Pac-Man, okay?
It sounds like it's literally
2017's Pac-Man.
I have been listening to some. Well, today's actually the start of the NHL hockey season, so I've been listening to some fantasy hockey podcasts.
There you go.
And yeah. I did my fantasy draft last night. So
I used to love just like trying to get better combos in Championship Edition or Championship Edition DX. Like, I think it's awesome that you can take just Pac-Man, you know, a 30-year-old template, and apply totally new ideas to it and make it. It still is obviously a Pac-Man game, but it plays totally differently than the original.
Yeah, it's been good. So that sort of inspired me to play a few other games with my controller, because I already had it plugged in and I was just browsing on Steam, feeling really indecisive. So I dug into this roguelike called Unexplored that was actually recommended in an article we published yesterday. I saw it and I downloaded it.
Everything I've heard about this game sounds really cool.
Yeah, Unexplored. I'll see if I can pull it up here while we're talking. But it's like a top-down roguelike, and
but it adds like physics right to the game. It's more so. One of the really cool things about roguelikes, when you get into them, less so like Binding of Isaac, I think more some of the more traditional games, they're really more about the story than they are just like getting through and killing stuff. They're about those crazy moments that happen when all the systems kind of bump into each other. And I think this game was sort of more built around the idea of creating those stories and telling them than it is about combat or experience or whatever.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you'd expect, you got these randomly generated levels. The games, you don't have to, but it definitely plays well with a controller. I wouldn't call it a twin stick shooter or anything like that. But as you can see, you know, you're sort of swinging your weapons, you're rotating, you have spells that you can cast out, but everything's randomized. You know, you have different floors that you're going through, but there's also some interesting kind of big D&D and rogue inspired elements where you're having to identify magical items. Like, you get a magical item, it could be cursed, it could let you.
It's probably cursed.
It's often cursed. So you have to find like scrolls of identify. You find like forges and other kind of like crafting stations throughout the world that you can walk up to, and you have to figure out, or at least like go to a wiki and figure out, you know, what stuff to put together. And in that way, it's very open in the sense that you can get yourself into a lot of trouble just by advancing forward really quickly, or you play very conservatively and amass stuff over time. And it also allows you to save, I should say, too. That's something that's very friendly and arguably unique. I mostly enjoy the combat system. There's sort of this nice, almost like fencing aspect to it where, okay, I can merely move straight forward with my weapon pointing at a guy and just poke him to cause damage. I can just sort of do that kind of poking, and I can use a shield and sort of block with, like that. When I swing, it has a cooldown. So you sort of lose that ability to swing the weapon freely again. But different swords have different arcs, and like a mace might swing wider, slower, heavier than like a short sword and stuff like that.
So is there a lot of kind of like skirting around enemies, kind of strafing around them as you swing sideways?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and in a lot of cases, you're using their throwing dagger to do two damage, and like whittling them down, or using bow and arrow. So I've only just started digging into it, and there's a lot of depth there. And I think the combat system is what stands out most.
How long does a typical run last?
I mean, I guess the times that I've died have been like 20 or 30 minutes, okay. But I don't have a sense of how deep the dungeon goes. Mm-hmm. I guess
the article that we have on the site recently that talks about Unexplored also mentions that they're doing a trilogy of free DLC add-ons for it, and I think the first two are out, and the third one is coming out sometime soon, and the third one is going to be like a murder mystery inside the dungeon. So it's kind of eschewing your normal just like get to the bottom of the dungeon and survive, and like you're actually looking for clues to some murder inside the dungeon, which sounds really cool and totally different than any roguelike I've ever played.
I'll just read this out real quick. The third and most interesting of the DLC is Dark Rituals, an eldritch murder mystery where you race against the clock to gather clues, learn which cultist is a living host to an elder god, and the very specific method by which you can slay them without causing the apocalypse.
That sounds fucking rad.
Yeah. Wow.
Like to know that there is like an NPC in the dungeon somewhere who's just a totally, totally nice guy, except they're hosting an elder's god that's going to cause the apocalypse unless you figure out who they are and kill them.
And it's very rogue in the sense that the game is unafraid to put these unimaginable challenges in front of you and just, you know, so what if you don't?
Good luck.
Yeah, exactly. You have to figure it out. So that's been fun. I spent a little bit of time in the Call of Duty World War II beta. I probably just refer people to Tyler's impressions that we posted this week. I only played like 4 or 5 matches. I had some stuttering issues, which discouraged me. But I don't know.
It seemed like Tyler was doing work with the M1 Garand.
Oh, yeah.
It's a classic ping, that gun. The end of the magazine ping.
A lot of people were upset in our comments to see that you could put sort of a reflex sight on the Garand, which people see as a modern sight. They did exist in kind of different forms back then, but yeah, you know, it's Call of Duty. They're sort of playing with what was.
I mean, be grateful they didn't put a laser pointer on it.
You're right. I don't know. I don't know what people expect. But
yeah, I played a little of the beta before this weekend because I went down to Sledgehammer last week, and it definitely feels structurally like a Modern Warfare era Call of Duty. You know, it doesn't feel like a total rebirth of that series or really going back to the first couple games. You know, it doesn't feel old-fashioned in that way. It feels like a modern Call of Duty game using old weapons, pretty much. You know, and so that does bring the power scale down. I think in a good way, if you like the way those games played, I think I would have been more interested in seeing it really shake things up more. And it feels like a very safe way to go back to World War II. So, you know, as soon as you start playing it, you're going to feel that Modern Warfare like DNA just in the movement system and stuff. So I think the campaign is actually going to be the more interesting thing this time around, because like they got rid of regenerating health for the campaign, for example. Right. So you're going to have to find health packs, and, you know, they have this big focus on the camaraderie of your characters. And if they pull that off, I think that will set it apart more from the past few games than the multiplayer.
Didn't Lawbreakers just put regenerating health back in?
Yes, if I remember right. Yeah, I haven't dug in since the most recent patch.
Yeah, we were doing it in news, I think.
Oh, that's a huge change.
It was a big change, yeah. We noted.
Yeah, they wanted to increase the time to kill.
I believe so, yeah.
As
people
I understand.
People were spawning and dying too often and spending too much time watching spawn timers was, I think, the rationale Cliff gave.
Yeah, yeah.
That's probably more of a problem for the plebs than for Evan, who would just fly over the map with his laser beam. No, you died plenty, but you were also always top of our team for kills too.
Thanks, Wes.
That was a fun yeah. game though. I want to keep playing it.
It's a super fun
every
game.
Now and then.
It's a super fun game. I'm curious. Maybe people have questions about it. If folks dug into it over the free weekend this past weekend, what they thought.
Yeah, it'd be cool to see that bump up their player counts post free weekend. You know,
I'd be interested to get a sense of why, if people haven't played it, which I suspect most won't have done, given the numbers, like what their reason for not wanting to give it a go is. Not that we're here to advertise for it, but I'm just curious to know what's turning you off. Or... Well,
we can dig into this a little bit.
So many games.
I think that's a big part of it. I wrote last month, I think it's a golden age for the first-person shooter multiplayer right now. There's just incredible choice, incredible quality. The fact that we had Quake, a new version of Quake, come out, one of the just classic, capital C classic, first-person shooters, and it's sort of not popular yet. I mean, it's an early access. You have to pay for it, and it's going to go free-to-play. It has these kind of weird business model things going on there, but... The fact that a Quake can come out and not take the world by storm just automatically tells you how kind of...
Do you think it's the shadow that Overwatch casts?
Well, I don't know, because, I really don't have a sense of how popular Overwatch is right now, honestly. I think it has plenty of players, but I want to know specifically how it compares to launch and a couple months after launch when it was, truly felt at its peak, right?
Yeah. I mean, they passed over 20 million... copies sold, I think. So obviously the potential player base is huge, but
yes.
Those people aren't always playing it all the time.
But Blizzard always talks in terms of downloads and stuff. They don't give you numbers for concurrents and stuff like that.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to hear. For me, I mean, the folks that haven't dug into Lawbreakers or why they're hesitant, I totally get why. I mean, the game doesn't have appealing characters on its surface. And this is actually something I'm writing about right now that we're getting ready to post a bunch of stories about the Orange Box. Next week is the 10-year anniversary of the Orange Box, way back in 2007.
Yeah, tune in Monday.
Yeah. One of the things I'm digging into, though, is Team Fortress 2 being the first game to really solve story and multiplayer and characterization in multiplayer. If you think about the classic FPSs of the 10, 20 years that preceded multiplayer, competitive FPSs that preceded Team Fortress 2, Quake, Battlefield, Counter-Strike, Rainbow Six, Tribes. What do those games have in common, right? It doesn't even attempt to tell stories or really tell you who you are.
Or create a universe, really. I mean, I guess the learning was almost taken from fighting games, right? If you think of something like Street Fighter 2, all you get is the end sequence when you beat the boss and a bit of...
Some really badly translated
and a couple of lines after each fight. But because of the look and the characters and, just that bio would be enough for you in your own mind to create this whole... look at the amount of fiction which has sprung up around something like a Street Fighter. It's pretty smart.
Exactly. And, we had this whole period... Up until TF2 and even after it, into games like Bioshock 2 and Spec Ops. Spec Ops The Line had a multiplayer mode. We had this whole era of what a lot of people referred to as, forced or shoehorned in multiplayer modes. Yeah. And Team Fortress 2 really broke that paradigm and taught people, I think, sort of solidified, actually, you can do this. You can create interesting characters and tell the story. They did a lot of it outside of the game, but that counts. They just utilized all the tools available to them in terms of, creating videos and YouTube, comics.
Overwatch is the exact same thing, right? There's not much story in Overwatch. You get little hints of lore and stuff, but it's all about great character design that's just inherently appealing, and then adding to that with all the lore in the comics or the videos.
And if you look at it through that lens as well, that would kind of probably explain a lot of why Titanfall 1 failed to resonate, because I don't think they did any of that kind of real storytelling or world building in a game that was purely multiplayer, and if I ended up having to retreat from that and create a campaign and try and give the robot in the not the robot but the mech suit in the campaign that kind of
personality.
Yeah, yeah, like there's a real tension, I think, like you're saying. If you're going to go down that multiplayer route, it's not enough to not have that other stuff, those other trappings.
Yes. And what do you get out of having inherently interesting characters? You get free marketing, for one thing. You get people who make fan art and memes out of their favorite characters. And
never underestimate the memes.
You know, like the passion that I have connecting with, I don't know, like Pharah or Zarya or...
Yeah, you have an emotional response Lucio. To the character you're playing, right? And the sense of like, I'm a good Genji main, right?
And you share that with other people, though.
Yeah.
That's the important thing, right? And you tell your friends and they see that and they want to be a part of that too. They want to connect to a character. So I think... I don't know, if I'm making a multiplayer shooter or a multiplayer game in 2017, 2018, I'm thinking about what is the face of this game, you know? And
I think one thing that has exacerbated that, but also led some games astray, is the popularity of Dota and League of Legends. I think those are the games that fully kicked off the your multiplayer game needs to be character-based and a ton of shooters and MOBA, you know, spin-off type games. Yeah. They took that, but also those games don't really have good characters, and I think the characters are the mechanics in MOBAs, and some of them kind of have succeeded in spite of that in having fan art based on them and sort of developing community around them. But I think way too many shooters just said, okay, we need characters, and then they just ripped off, like, we're going to have Sun Wukong in the game because Wukong is in every freaking MOBA, and we're going to have the Archer Lady, and we're going to have, you know, just the big, like, tree tank guy or whatever.
I think for a while there was a consensus as well that the guns were the characters in shooters as well, and what mattered really was just getting a good set of guns, which Lawbreaker does, but I think that has been like disproved by stuff like Overwatch,
or even the maps in some cases.
And the maps,
too.
Yeah. And I mean, it's also as well not enough just to jam in some cartoony, tropey kind of characters. You look at like something like Dirty Bomb, the splash damage game, which had tried to do a lot of that sort of stuff, but I think didn't particularly resonate because of whether it's the art or the
clearly having the character isn't enough by itself. You need that extra something, something.
It's tough. I mean, you need great voice actors. You need writers, I think. If we're thinking about Team Fortress 2, that's the big distinction for me. They had writers who are deeply integrated into the design for 5, 8, 10 years now.
League of Legends has a huge writing and story team for a game where you'd go like, oh, what's the story? But like,
and they went to a lot of efforts to totally overhaul that. Because in the beginning, I'm sure they did have writers on the team, but they had this very... just in service of the game lore, right? It was like, we're on the Field of Legends, we're on Summoner's Rift, and there's these little, like, you know, dwarf guys over here, and they hate these other people, and blah, blah. Like, there was more to it than that, but it was kind of nebulous, and they did, like, a total reboot of their lore and spent way more effort creating the story around the characters to give them the reason to be fighting each other.
Cool. Well, nice tangent. But I want to make sure we have time for Wes to dig into Divinity.
Oh boy.
Original Sin 2, which we've been trying to talk about coherently over the past couple of weeks, but we haven't had you or Tyler on the show to really dig into in a big way. So
Tyler's probably well ahead of me. I think the game is four acts, and the first act takes place entirely on this one island. But if you've played the first Divinity, you'll kind of understand how much they can squeeze into one area. The original Divinity was set in kind of like three separate giant maps, basically, and you could easily spend 20 or 30 hours per each of those areas just finding just so much stuff. You know, just when you think you've covered an area, you go, oh no, there's a cave over here that was kind of invisible unless you looked at it from this camera angle, and you can go in there and there's like a whole set of quests in there and stuff like that. So I'm on the island. You play as a group of like sorcerers who have been basically caught and tried for their sorcerous ways. You get these like collars put on your neck so you can't use really powerful source magic, and then they throw you on this island with a bunch of like kind of evil cultist religious people who are like clamping down on everyone on the island, keeping the prisoners in line. And if you step out of line, they will try to kill you, which is why there are no more magisters on my island, because we have killed all of them.
Well done hunting down the magic police.
I mean, it almost killed the magic police real good.
It almost reminds me of a lot of Dragon Age 2, kind of taking to the extreme where you have, you know, the wardens basically as this like guardian force keeping magic in check. But
it is very much that concept with like a sprinkling of religious worship involved and who's supposed to be able to use magic and stuff.
Like the Novigrad bit in Skyrim as well, right?
Isn't that in The Witcher?
Skyrim. Witcher, yeah. Where the magicians are on the run.
Yeah, they're like chasing down Triss. And yeah, it's very much that.
Getting quite burny, as I remember.
Yeah, there's actually a part in Original Sin 2 where you find some people being sacrificed or having the magic. I think they're basically getting their souls ripped out of their bodies. It's a little grotesque, but the game's, I think, really good so far. It does role-playing way, way, way better than the first game. Original Sin 1 had kind of a goofy story that I kind of checked out of halfway through the game, and my friend and I who co-opted it were mostly just in it for the combat is really fun, and like the story was serviceable. You'd get some fun jokes and stuff, but this one, instead of having pre-written dialogue for your character, you have like these expressive almost kind of Mass Effect style like commands where you're choosing a way to react to something, and it gives you sort of a sketch of what you're gonna say, but it's you kind of choosing that action, and then the other people respond to you. So it feels more like you're playing the character that you're controlling. And then there's lots of dialogue systems to let you play with your co-op friends if you're playing together, or if you're managing the whole party yourself, you kind of just get to have your characters like bounce opinions off of each other, you know, or like they can conflict with what they want to do. So you can have one character say like, this guy was a murderer, we should kill him, he deserves no quarter, and then have your other character be like, we've all done some bad things now and then, I think we should let him free,
as he gazes awkwardly at the huge pile of magisters to the left.
But there's so many things in this game that are like just hardcore PC RPG, encourage you to do save scumming or whatever you want if you don't want to live with the repercussions of your actions, because it is not afraid to give you severe repercussions for what you do. Like one of my friends that I'm co-oping with has been putting points into thievery, and he's now started trying to pickpocket people. And so we went to this camp of people who helped us out. They actually took our source collars off. So this was like a very nice group of people. They had all these like skill books they were selling. So it was a great place for us to level up and like get some new quests and stuff. And this one guy had some really good loot. So my friend decided to try to steal it from him. And he succeeded, but then the guy started going around asking all of our characters if he could check our bags because he noticed something was missing, and he wanted to. He was like, I noticed somebody stole all my money. Would you show me your bag?
And this was not scripted per se. Like it was triggered.
It was triggered. Yes, it wasn't like a specific event, because this actually happened with two characters that he tried to pickpocket. So it's a thing that's maybe all the characters in the game or some of them will do to try to find the objects that have been taken from them.
Man,
this guy happened to be a squire, a little full of himself. And after asking me to check my bag, he basically just told me he didn't like me. He was like, you look kind of smug or something, I don't know. And I responded to that. I don't remember exactly what I said to him, but that triggered a fight with him and therefore everyone who was friendly to him, which was the entire camp. So we could either reload or slaughter all of these people who were kind of on our side. So we chose to reload.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, as a pen and paper RPG player, that sounds like one of the truest representations of pen and paper Dungeons and Dragons that I've heard, right?
What feels like a spark of spontaneity or creativity.
Because, I mean, I guess depending on the group of people you're playing D&D with, but if you're playing D&D, you know what it's like to be with someone who's like, I'm just going to try and steal everything I can. Mm-hmm. Like, because I want to like get under the skin of the DM or the game, or it's just like, it's fun to me to subvert in this game of imaginary play where there's no like engine driving it. To poke at what's possible, right?
Do you think, was there a way of successfully getting past that guy without enraging everyone and still keeping the stuff?
Yeah, I think we actually did eventually. I think he was able to pick... At one point, he tried pickpocketing him again, and he just got caught, and that started a fight. I think he may have ended up pickpocketing him, and then we just kept our other characters far enough away or something that he didn't trigger that. So there's lots of ways you can do that.
Are you not tempted kind of to them just to stop fucking trying to steal the whole time?
That's we're gonna get there eventually, because we're mostly out of resurrection scrolls, which you need to bring a character back to life, and they're fairly expensive.
You're out of those, eh?
Yeah. So at some point, we're gonna just go back to the main town probably and just try to steal from everyone we can. But okay, so I have one especially good story from last night. So probably 10 hours earlier in the game, we're about like 18 hours in at this point. I one of my characters, the Red Prince, who's this kind of cast aside ruler from like a far off kingdom, he has this talent called Pet Pal that lets you talk to animals in the world. One of the best traits in the game. You can use it to find out tons of information about quests, and like you get funny dialogue from talking to dogs and cats. And in this case, a rat. I think it was Eddie the rat, if I'm remembering the right rat. That I talked to, and he had this kind of weird, these weird hints about a place with like black roses and how there was something very powerful there. Didn't tell me where it was, but I knew it was some other part of this island, that there was like a quest there or something worth investigating. So that was like a week ago. Last night we end up finding this cave, and there's a witch in it, who we end up getting in a fight with because she's after these very powerful, this like powerful magic in this cave. And she raises a bunch of corpses from the cave, partially people she had killed.
Yeah, that'll do that.
So that already got into this pretty big fight. She was like equal level with us and pretty strong. So we're fighting her and like five corrupted kind of minions and corpses that she had summoned up. We're doing okay. And then at one point I use on my main character this ability called Purge to absorb a dead body and take a point of source magic from it, which is like a kind of a powerful commodity. I was able to use this ability Purge because earlier we had found this cursed helmet that belonged to Brockus Rex, who is like a character in the Divinity lore. He's actually in the first game, but he was basically a mad king who like stole the source magic, aka the souls, out of a bunch of people and like stored them up. So I was like, oh cool, I have this cursed helmet. It gives me like one negative trait, but it gives me this special skill and has like some good stats on it. So I use this Purge skill. It was maybe like the third or fourth time I'd used it since putting the helmet on, and from the cursed helmet spawned a demon that was the thing that had cursed the helmet, apparently, and just showed up in the middle of the fight. That at that point was going pretty well, and then all of a sudden was not going well at all because this demon showed up, and he was like higher level than us. He was cursed. He could cast cursed magic on us that would like make our bodies like decay, and if you get a healing spell put on you when you're decaying, it does not heal you, it hurts you. Very bad news. He would bleed cursed blood when you hit him, which will curse you, and mix with regular blood and turn that blood cursed. So all of a sudden, that fight got way more interesting and way harder and dicier for us because I used this ability that, like, really I didn't need to use, but it seemed fine at the time.
So were your party mates like, where did this demon come from?
Yes. I mean, we were all like, what the hell just happened?
His buddy was busy probably trying to steal from the demon's pocket.
He probably thought about it. So we ended up taking him down, but it was like two of our characters died in the process. And
that's where the resurrection scrolls went.
Yep. Yeah, is exactly where they went. Yeah. So that's just kind of thing. Like, this game has so many little things packed in it where you would just not expect, you know, you would think of like a cursed item as having a set condition where it's just going to cause some negative, but they went the extra mile of attaching some narrative to this item. And I'm sure there are other things in the game similar to that, that just like, we just were not prepared for it at all. It was a result of us taking kind of sloppy action and just really, really fun.
And you know, you telling that story, it really, I don't know, makes me realize what a missed opportunity it's been for so many RPGs, right? They treat weapons and armor and equipment as purely qualitative stat stuff. Like, if you're lucky, you're going to get some flavor text, or it'll have a unique name, or
maybe its own effect.
Yeah. yeah, particle effect or something, but the idea of actually, what if we put all this like qualitative, unique stuff behind an item where it has its own history and story? And obviously you can't do that with anything unless, unless like you make it procedural and make that randomized in some way for a certain set of items. But like, that's again, straight out of D&D, you know, like swords having their own history, being, having voices and stuff like that. People have been doing that in Dungeons & Dragons for decades.
Totally. I noticed someone in the chat saying, normally that demon spawns out of combat and you can have a conversation with him, as far as I know. So that's the kind of shit that can just happen in Divinity. I was in combat when I did that, and so he just instantly was, you know, aggroed on us.
I am the demon of your helmet. I will now grant you three wishes. Now die! Because I accidentally got hit by an arrow or something.
Yep.
Wow. So... that's pretty amazing, Wes. I know you played a lot of the first Divinity in co-op as well.
Yeah, actually. Yeah.
What are sort of the broad strokes bullet points of systemic improvements, or even stuff that you'd maybe be critical of or missing from the first game at all?
That's a good question.
Straight upgrade.
I don't think there's anything missing from the first game. I'm really impressed by the way, like saving and doing things with your characters in different locations works in Divinity, because it really feels totally seamless. There's no fail point there that I've experienced. So you don't even think about it. You're just like, I'm off in this part of the map. Somebody else is in a cave or a dungeon on the other side of the world in a different, you know, kind of instance, right? They're not in the same environment. There's no lag issues there. It doesn't stop you from going someplace because somebody else is somewhere else. You can hit save and it just works, and you can reload that save, and then when your people rejoin the game, you can just make sure they're assigned to control the right characters and it's exactly the where you left off. So it all works so well that you don't even think about it, but that must have been a hell of an engineering challenge to not have sync issues, to keep all that stuff running smoothly. So that stuff all works really well. I can't think of anything it's missing from the first game. It does four-player co-op now instead of just two-player. So if you're interested in playing a game like that co-op, I say absolutely go for it. It's a great experience. You just have to kind of give up controlling everything. You know, like if I was controlling all four characters in the party in combat, I would probably be planning very deliberately who's going to do what when, and like making the best of those synergistic combinations.
Right.
We're doing some of that in four player, but it's kind of, we don't know exactly what skills each other have because we're not staring at them the whole time. And it gives you a lot of opportunities for messing up and having funny or annoying or entertaining things happen, which I really enjoy. But if you're all about, you know, the perfect play, like you'd probably rather play it by yourself. But I think either way, it's a lot of fun.
Well, playing with your friends and screwing up sounds a lot more fun.
Yeah, I like that aspect of it because yes, we're dying more in combat than we probably would otherwise, but that's where the fun of it is. Like in that encounter with the demon, one of my friends was down to like 12 health and he managed to walk his way out of some cursed blood, get away from this demon guy, and wanted to heal himself. But instead of drinking a potion, he made it rain blood because he has an ability to absorb blood to heal himself. But when he made it rain, the new blood mixed with the pool of cursed blood already on the ground brought that over to where he was standing and then killed him. So that's the kind of thing that would not have happened if I was controlling the character, but it's like going to be one of the most memorable parts of that fight is like the time where he barely survived through the exact proper sequence of actions and then killed himself by messing up.
Trying to drink a delicious blood shake didn't work out, surprisingly.
Be careful when you make it rain blood, because it's not always good for you.
Pen and paper slapstick. Sounds great. Well, glad to have you share some of those anecdotes.
Yeah, play Divinity if you're not playing it already. It's great.
It seems like, I think you're only about 20 hours in or something.
Yeah, but like 18, something like that. We probably have 50 more to go. I don't know.
Man.
There's a lot of game there. He thinks he's going to sink 200 hours into it.
Oh my God. What?
It's a lot of game. Yeah.
That's wild. Well, thanks for sharing, Wes. So another recent game we want to be talking about this week is Cuphead, but not just about what we think of its interesting illustration style and its take on platforming, but the conversation about difficulty in games that it spawned, both on Twitter and some other folks writing about it. So if you're not familiar with Cuphead, it is a fully hand-illustrated platformer developed by an independent developer. And yeah, it's been in the works for a long time, delayed a couple times, and it's local co-op, but generally I think, I don't know, most people aren't playing with two people at their PC.
Probably mostly playing solo, yeah.
Probably playing solo. So again, as you can see here on the live stream, it's very much in the style of old cartoons. And the game is really structured as a series of boss fights for the most part. There are some kind of platforming sequences as you're moving left to right across the screen, but you're in this sort of overworld map, wandering around, seeing which boss fights you can complete. And
it has some degree of an upgrade system, right? Like you get some different, you know, Contra style weapons and a lot of Gunstar Heroes influence in there from what I've seen, but it's pretty much just kill bosses.
Exactly. And there's like a store where you can equip different items and like mild upgrades. So if you want to, like there's a, by default, you're just shooting in a straight pattern at like high speed, but there's a weapon type where it like boomerangs slightly, so you can like hang in the air a little bit longer to do extra damage. So you're playing with different weapon types. And there's also a...
is there a spread gun?
I think that there's like a short range, high damage spread gun as well. And there's sort of an arcing weapon and stuff like that. So it's not, it's sort of embracing some more modern ideas there, I guess. But I jumped in for the first time last night and I was just delighted with the style of it. I think that's the obvious thing to say.
It's hard not to be if you have ever seen a cartoon and don't hate cartoons for some reason. Like, this is the closest thing to a real cartoon I think any game has accomplished.
I think you're aware from the very first moment you hit that title screen and there's this custom song being played just for the title screen that's like explaining the plot of the game, and you go into a cutscene, you're just immediately aware of the density of work that the game represents. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you're not sort of in this environment where assets are being reused. You're really aware. I don't know. Maybe it's like our perspective as journalists saying this, like all of this was created by hand, you know, like this level that you're playing for 5 minutes probably took somebody multiple months.
The details in those backgrounds and in the animations is insane.
Yeah.
Like crazy.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the delight of playing it, is just sort of, you know, like when you go into a new map, you're going to get an entirely new set of assets and kind of a different experience. So I don't know. There's something to be said, you know, for the raw, just audio visual flavor that's being put in front
of you. Did you manage to kill any bosses?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, you know, people are, the big conversation right now is how difficult Cuphead is. And it is pretty challenging. It took me multiple attempts on every boss, but I think there's about 28 of them across the game.
That sounds right.
Yeah, and I've cleared 6 or 7 at this point, and that was just in an hour, like one sitting. So, I mean, I definitely struggled at points, but I thought it was really elegant the way that it wasn't sort of the sort of abrasive difficulty, in my opinion, where it's arbitrary, it's hitting you from nowhere. I thought in the bosses that I played, they've done a great job of, there's the right amount of randomization and predictability.
Could you quickly pass what it was that it wanted you to do to beat the boss, like the patterns and stuff? Like, what like was it like mechanically hard, just trying to dodge the amount of stuff they were kind of pumping out, like bullet hell sort of style, or was it more like, I don't know what I'm doing here?
There was, so far there hasn't been a moment that where I had to solve some puzzle or, you know, like really outthink something, or it was trying to trick me. It was pure technique, I'd say. The only exception was at the outset, I was fighting this, okay, this sounds ridiculous, two frogs that transform into a cash register. Anyway.
Hey, it was the 1930s, no judgment.
It happens. So when they transform the cash register, they have this like, you know, arm that you would pull to like open the tray or something like that. And it turns pink and I'm like, oh, what's that? You know, and I kept shooting at it and I didn't understand. Then I like went back and did the tutorial real quick, and it's like, oh, anything that's pink in the world, you do this move called a parry, which is like a jump, and then you hit the jump button again, and you basically block it. So it's a way of sort of interacting with and actually building up your super meter as well and sort of teaching you that in an early stage. So that was the only exception. I found it great. I can't wait to get back home and play it and hopefully finish it this weekend or next week. But yeah, let's dig into this conversation about difficulty, because there's, independent developers on Twitter have been weighing in, as well as some of our colleagues.
I will not be playing Cuphead.
You will not be playing Cuphead.
I'm 40 years old. There's no, like, my hands can't do what it wants you to do.
Well, it's interesting. So we should say that Cuphead has for each boss, at the outset or level, you can pick between a simple mode and I guess it's called standard or normal. I can't remember actually. But you can play the simple mode and you can like defeat the boss, but it sort of emits some of their moveset. Mm-hmm. They have lower health total, but most importantly, you actually can't advance. The whole fiction of the game is you're these very likable cup characters who
Cuphead and Mugman.
Who wandered into a casino owned by the devil. Whoops. The premise is one of my favorite things about the game. you play craps and you like bet your souls and you lose your souls, of course.
Are they the last of the kitchenware folk?
No, you live in this house owned by a grandfatherly teapot character.
Of course.
Anywho, your cups, you lose your souls in the devil's casino, and then you're basically hitmen for the devil, going to collect the souls of his other debtors, who are these boss characters who you're fighting.
That's such a great premise.
I know, it's super.
You're being kind of an asshole. Like, you're stealing people's souls.
I know. Often it's the souls of like giant psychic carrots, for example. So anywho, in order to collect those souls, you have to beat each level on the standard difficulty level.
Right.
And so say there's like world one. And world two, and I think there's like a third or fourth one. You can't advance. You can't like get on a boat to cross to the second world unless you collect all the souls by playing on the standard difficulty and completing the level. Okay. So there is a way to play it in a more easier fashion, but you can't progress.
Only the first third of the game or something. Yeah.
Exactly. So a lot of folks are asking, well, I paid $20 for this game. Isn't it my right as a player to determine how I should play it? It's like it's intentionally gating me. If I don't have the motor skills, if I'm not used to the style of the game, I didn't grow up playing Mega Man or Gunstar Heroes or whatever else, like, should I sort of have some more freedom there to control how I want to play this game? Because again, we're talking about at the outset here, Cuphead is in a way like this beautiful collection of art and sound. I think the soundtrack is one of the best things about the game. And you just want to keep playing these new levels because you're exposed to all these gorgeous new assets, right? So isn't, as the developers sort of limit the way that you can play, they're saying like, okay, you can play in this easy mode, but you can't actually move forward in the game. You have to play it our way in order to really experience all the content. Does that rub you guys the wrong way at all? Because that certainly has on Twitter for some folks.
I think the only thing you have a right to is the disc you bought or the digital license to the thing you downloaded. I think it's totally up to the developers what, their artistic vision for the game. I don't think there's really an argument you have there as a consumer. Like, do your research on the thing you're buying. If you end up being pissed that you can't access certain content because you're not good enough, it's too bad for you. You could have found that out probably before you bought the game. But I think the bigger question is, what does it add or subtract from a game for the developers to design different ways of playing it and different ways of accessing that content, different types of accessibility where they make concessions for people who maybe can't use a game controller because they, they're one-handed or they have some kind of muscular issue. And I think making those kind of concessions is, again, the developers aren't required to do it, but I think is a great thing to do that I would love to see in all games. Yeah.
And I would go back to what you said earlier, Wes, about information. Like, this is a game that's been broadly promoted and sold as like a hardcore platformer with a pretty sweet art style. And in that sense, it's delivered. So going into that world, I wouldn't expect to be able to just cruise my way through it in the same sense as I wouldn't expect to be able to select a difficulty mode for Dark Souls. Like, it is what it is. You go in there pretty much knowing. I can see people being pissed if they get into a game that's billed as one thing and it's got like a wildly off curve difficulty spike, like, you know,
yeah,
that's when I can see people being irritated.
There's no good one size fits all rule, right? Because so many games are built so differently.
Well, I think one of the things at work here that people aren't really talking about or identifying is the theme of the game and the cartoony, childish, like, accessible, you know, every character in the game is pretty much smiling at you in like, yeah, this broad grin. It has a very, like, inviting style that almost betrays how difficult it is.
Mm-hmm. And I used to feel that about, like, even, like, getting off, unfortunately, PC games, but I used to feel that with Mario back in the days, where, like, my sisters, sure, so I used to play games with my sisters all the time, we would get the new Mario, they're all younger than me, they'd love Mario, but would hit a wall really early, because Mario, it turns out, is quite hard, especially for, like, you know, people who aren't,
yeah, I'm bad at
super
Mario,
super regular gamers, yeah, but it is in contradiction to how sunny and bright and friendly you assume it's going to be.
Oh, for sure. So, and that's kind of one of the key subtopics I want to dig into here, which is games were so much more difficult as an average in the 90s, yeah, and even the early 2000s. I mean, you think about just old console platformers and how brutally they would not allow you to progress unless you mastered these arbitrary skills.
And often, I think, right? Just through bad design, like,
yes,
the, yeah, responsiveness of the controls or, you
hit,
know,
hit detection.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Friend of mine and I, when we were playing games back on, he had a BBC Micro, which was like a very early personal computer in the UK, run on BASIC. And he had the game called Exile, which was...
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, it was like an adventure game set in space. You're an astronaut mooned on a planet. It's like 2D side-on. It's almost like proto-Metroid sort of thing.
Okay.
And you had some, like, it had like realistic physics. You could pick stuff up. He and I didn't understand. We must have been like probably less than 10 years old, but did not understand how to get out of the opening area. But we explored the opening area for days at a time. I like real world days. Like, we would just sit like, there's the beaker and we're trying to fill it up with stuff, and there's the bird. Do we need to do something with the bird? Like, we had no clue. But, like,
was it just like walk to the right?
I'm sure if I went back now, the solution was very simple. I mean, this was back in the days when games would ship with a book accompanying it, when the story would be in a book.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like, I'm an old man and things were definitely harder back in time.
So the argument of some folks looking back at those games is that they would be more interesting, more fun if I was able to somehow press a button and skip forward or dial down the difficulty, give myself more hit points. If some kind of control was available to me to say, this is too hard for me, but I want to keep playing. I just can't figure out this segment. It's outside of my reach. So I don't know, like, how has our perspective changed, you know, 10, 20 years ago where it was, I don't know.
People are bigger babies now, but I'm being like semi-serious. Like,
sure.
I mean, I hate that it's such an easy criticism to make of entitlement. And I understand, you know, games are really expensive and people want to extract value from them. I do get that. But at the same time, I think, like, there is a general trend in gaming. Like, I remember speaking to developers like 10 years ago who they would talk about, and this is on PlayStation, they talk about, you know, the people who had got the trophies from the latter part of the game was minuscule. And the same way, you know, you look at the Steam achievements, right? You can see what percentage people complete games and it's pretty small. And I think generally speaking, games are trending much harder towards, like, barriers to entry being super low, going kind of broad, not deep. And I think it's great when you've got something like Divinity Sin where it almost like bucks that trend, you know, of like not trying to be cater to like the broadest possible crowd, but actually finding a really big audience because of that, because there is people out there who really crave that sort of deep experience.
At the same time, I think, you know, we talk about games are better designed now than they were in the 90s, for example, when it comes to things like hit detection or, yeah, you know, the controls letting you jump over a gap instead of falling in it. Like, design has come so far, and I think there's absolutely room for more and more games to include modes that let you skip parts of the game if those aren't what the designers deem like integral to the experience, right? Like, should you be able to skip boss fights in games that for some people are just a wall that they will never get over? Well, probably not in Cuphead or a game like, there was an indie game called Titan Souls that was just a boss rush game. You'd go find a boss in the environment and beat it. If you could just skip that, that was kind of the entire intent of the game, mm-hmm, was to experience.
Shadow of the Colossus is another good example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But what if it's a game like Mass Effect or like Deus Ex Human Revolution is a great example. They kind of owned up to the fact that their boss fight sucked. I think they were like outsourced. They didn't fit in with the theme of the game. All of a sudden it was pure combat when before it was all about sneaking and talking and everything, right? Like,
it was more that you could completely level up down the stealth path, get to the boss and they go, yeah, just those skills aren't going
to
work.
Exactly, like, right? So if there was a button in that game to skip the boss fight so that you could get to the rest of the narrative, the rest of the sneaking or whatever, is that...
You don't need the skip button. You need better designed boss fights and better designed
progress
system. That's
the ideal,
right?
Yeah. But I think there is nuance there in maybe even a better designed Mario level is still too hard for... Yeah. Your, you know, 4-year-old sister to beat it. Is it so bad that Nintendo puts a mode in that gives you like an invincibility suit so that you can get through that level? I don't think that's so bad. I don't want to use it. I want to overcome that challenge. You know, but if it lets that kid get to the next level that they can beat, but they just couldn't handle that one situation, well, that's fine.
I guess that's part of what irritates me most about this argument, which is the notion that levels or segments or bosses, you know, sort of the content, the stuff I haven't experienced yet in the game is in fact like this quote unquote content, you know, and it really emphasizes games as products to me in a way that I absolutely detest, mm-hmm. right? It's a way of saying like, I paid $20, $30, $60 for this and I have a right to play level 4. And I like that is sort of this untapped thing that I need to sort of put in front of my eyes and ears and touch and feel, as opposed to acknowledging that, okay, actually the boss at level 2, what you paid for is the experience of frustration.
Yeah, but it's
and
also
that,
like,
and that actually might be intentional on a developer's part, like,
yeah,
and overcoming that.
But if you tried to like remove that, and if you tried to like, yeah, I think it would be impossible anyway, but design games that catered for every single potential player, I mean, that's even saying it is ridiculous, but it's antithetical to what games are, right? Like, a lot of games, not all, but a lot of games depend on like you honing a technique and enjoying that sense of like mastery over a particular set of skills. Like, if you were to like to use an example of the game I'm not playing on PC but will be later this month, Destiny, you could not make like raid encounters that everyone who plays that game is going to play, or like you couldn't make the trials multiplayer mode suitable for everyone. Like, that's by their very nature, they're intended to be like, you know, high-end activities for people who've done everything else and mm-hmm. now want to test themselves against something tougher.
I think we also have to acknowledge here that one of the things brought up in some of these discussions is, okay, why don't you just lower the hit points of this or somehow scale it down so it's easier, right? Like, you don't have to omit content. You don't have to omit the moves of the boss. I think that's a really foolish argument because, again, if you get into Destiny, you know, imagine sort of an easy mode version of those Destiny raids where the bosses have 75% hit points or 50%. The weapons now feel totally differently. The magazine capacity operates differently. Like, the structure of teamwork and synergies operate differently. Like, you can't just sort of dial down en masse like this literal dial on a game design and say, okay, everything's 50% easier now. Like, everything is, I don't know, connected, you know, and has like a really deliberate relationship in how things are balanced, and it doesn't scale perfectly if you go up or down.
It's funny you mention that, because I have seen that suggested, that they should have like kind of like a baby's pool version of the raid, which does have like simplified mechanics, but I think it's like really, it's a really like you're kind of saying, I think, like a naive assessment of what that design work actually entails.
And even if there was a low effort way to do that, does it harm their perception of their overall product by putting in an easy mode that's like actually kind of shit, right? Like, if they just tone down the health to 10% to everything, like, yeah, a lot more people could beat that. Does that harm the overall game by having that in there?
The funny thing is, actually, which is I think sort of a related point, is I'm actually more and more persuaded that they would love to not make those modes, because I think they are played by such a small chunk of the player base that versus the development cost that goes into it, these are like vast play spaces with very complicated mechanics that can be very buggy because of the way some of the interactions work.
Yeah,
I think they'd love to not include raids. They'd love to not, but the problem is it's become known for that amongst a certain segment of the community. The other counterpoint is, I am sort of persuaded by the idea of like, it's perfectly fine for some games to be really easy, even like big blockbustery games. There's plenty of games like we were talking about earlier, like, you know, having a podcast on or watching something on the second screen, where I don't really want to be challenged. I enjoy even with something like XCOM, I like playing it easy. I like feeling powerful versus the aliens, cruising around, building my team up. I don't really, and I know plenty of people feel completely the opposite about it. They want the high stress. Mm. I want controlled stress. And I think one of the examples we were talking about when we discussed this story was what Assassin's Creed Origins is doing, where they're gonna patch in, I think, in 2018. This tourism mode where you're going to be able to explore ancient Egypt with all the combat and the quests stripped out and just kind of check yourself out some pyramids and some tombs and meet some of the historical characters.
I think that's a really cool idea.
I love it, yeah. And I remember like Kieran Gillen once at this parish saying, you know, like he in his great manifesto for new games journalism should be like travel writing. And I kind of actually like the idea of some games being like tourism, like, you know, taking you to these amazing places and just exploring. Like so much of games are, you know, built on conflict and mastery of skill. I definitely think it's interesting at least to have that as an option.
I think so too. One of the examples I keep thinking back to that illustrates this is playing GoldenEye on the N64 as a kid. And one thing I think is great about GoldenEye, kind of a different discussion, is the way you would earn everything in the game, in like stuff that would be in a loot box now or would be like locked behind a paywall. Ooh. Or something, right?
Oh,
like
an actual sense of sadness when
like,
you said that.
I want sensitive like, subject. The paintball mode or the multiplayer maps, right?
Yep.
I loved the intricacy with which you unlocked all these different little variables and weapons and maps and all this stuff by completing missions under certain time limits, beating them on certain difficulty settings. And those difficulty settings were really interestingly designed because they added whole new sections of kind of mission to a level instead of just being like enemies are tougher now, right? At the same time, some of the stuff they locked away in that game, and I think also the like one of the following James Bond games, like The World's Not Enough or something, you had to play a multiplayer level, you had to beat like a certain mission on the hardest difficulty in like 4 minutes or something like that. And there were some maps that I never got to play in multiplayer because they were so hard to unlock that I couldn't do it. I don't think I feel entitled to that content. I do think that wasn't the best design. Yeah. Because if it had been like the super secret level at the end of the game that's your reward for like beating this mission on a super hard difficulty, cool, that makes sense. If it's the mode that I want to play with my friends and we're just like doing deathmatch and we can't have another multiplayer map because in single player I wasn't good enough as that, maybe in hindsight not the best design there. But we still had plenty of other maps to play, so, you know, we got over it.
For me, especially in single-player games, cheat codes are one of the best solutions to this whole question, right, of accessibility, because codifying it as a mode for developers is almost, you know, tampering with their intentions. So if Cuphead had an easy mode, you could just toggle things on, explore the whole game at once, not have to worry about progression, you know, the hit points are scaled down, whatever they do. They're really sort of changing and sending a mixed message about what the game is and their intentions as a developer, which at least I feel a responsibility to respect. Now, I want to experience the game as they put it out there, partly as a critic. But a cheat code, again, it's sort of this like hidden back-end way where like, yes, they've programmed it in the game, but you have to sort of go through the process of executing some input or toggling something on in a menu and saying like, and acknowledging almost quietly to yourself that like, you're circumventing that, you know what I mean?
I remember when if you selected easy mode in Ninja Gaiden, the old ninja game, it would make you wear a pink ribbon.
Ninja dog mode, is that what they call it?
Yeah, for the whole of the game. Sexist.
Like NES or PlayStation?
No, this was on. This would have been on
The Xbox.
The Xbox, probably.
Oh, okay, right. Team Ninja.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, it's been a fun topic. I mean, this all kind of originated with the video that circulated from a GamesBeat reporter, right? Trying to complete the Cuphead tutorial, struggling for, I don't know, 10 or 20 minutes or something.
I think you made a really good point about attaching the like the dollar value of the thing you purchase to this assumption that you're buying content and that you deserve to experience all of that content before you paid for it. Like it's a complicated thing to kind of pick apart, but I think that's not the way you should look at games.
Yeah, I think that's depriving yourself of something special, which is this notion of like there's something interesting even if, okay, it's all subjective, right? Like how you measure the value of a game. But for me, a game making me mad has value in a lot of cases, because I'm walking away saying like, wow, that game made me feel something. Like that's significant, you know, like even if it's rage quitting, I think that that's an achievement in some ways, assuming I'm not like grappling with some technical difficulty or something.
When I used to play Hotline Miami, I came out of every session that absolutely frigging wired. I could only play for like 20 minutes at a time, and then I'd be like, But going back to the GameSpeak guy, and I'm not, apologies if I get the details wrong, but like, if we were commissioning someone to review a pretty hardcore driving game, say like Forza, you're not going to give it to someone who doesn't really play driving games very often. It doesn't need to be like, I don't think you need to get someone who's the best driver of driving games who could have like, there's not esports driving games, I don't think, but you know what I mean? Like could have turned pro. Like what you need to do is find someone who can play that game to a level where they can speak to the typical audience, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the GameSpeak thing went wrong, is like that was a genre well out of his comfort zone.
Well, also seemingly. He like put it up as a video that was basically saying, look how much I failed at this. And then people got really mad at him for failing at it. Like it was meant to be kind of
a joke,
kind of jokey. Yeah.
Well, as is the case,
so he wasn't saying this game's bad because I'm bad.
Not at all. No, okay. It wasn't a review. So
as is the case on the internet, not just in gaming, but in gaming for sure, people take stuff like this and they turn it into ammunition for their narratives. Unfortunately, so we had a lot of folks saying like, "Look how bad game journalists are at video games." Man, I could name so many folks who are some of the best people at specific games that write about games. You know, it was unfortunate to see it.
I mean, you don't need to be a Michelin-starred chef to go and like critique the food in a restaurant.
Yeah. I mean, how many sports writers are great basketball players or hockey players or anything else, right?
And at the same time, you can easily react to seeing the unedited, so to speak, version of something versus the edited version. You know, like Michelin star chefs, they've made plenty of bad meals. Those just aren't the meals that you normally see from them, right? And like at the same time, you're gonna see lots of gameplay videos on YouTube. You can look up a game and get a montage of like sick no scopes and like amazing Battlefield moments. The rest of the footage that they clip that out of is just like walking down the middle of the street or like getting sniped from somebody from 100 yards away and just being like, well, that sucked. I should, you know.
I got my legend card back in Hearthstone. Evan's a murderer with a sniper rifle. We've got it going on PC Gamer. Don't you worry about that.
I used to be okay at Halo.
There you go.
That's all I got.
There you go.
Well, it'll be interesting to continue to have this conversation. I think, you know, I'm trying to think about what other games are going to prompt this. We have some other Dark Souls style games on the way for sure.
Neo coming to PC.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Definitely. Cool, guys. Well, now is a part of the show where we transition into taking your questions. And if you got one, if you're hanging out with us today on Twitch, definitely tag us as @PCGamer. And we will look to get to it in the next 10 or 15 minutes as we wrap up here. If you happen to be a PC Gamer Club member, all the better. And we'll definitely bring your question to the front of the line here as we wrap up the show. So if you haven't heard about PC Gamer Club, it's our all-in-one membership and community program over at club.pcgamer.com. You get a free digital subscription to our magazine every month. You get a free game code every month, plus like additional game codes that we just throw your way, beta keys. We gave away beta codes for a game called The Amazing Eternals, which is the next game from the creators of Warframe.
Cool.
This past month, that's pretty cool.
Tub Geralt wallpaper.
You get a 4K wallpaper of Tub Geralt.
Best RPGs handbook as well. You get a digital copy of that.
Yeah.
When you sign up, and you get to hang out with us in Discord.
That's right. So a lot of benefits. So if you're interested in that, that sounds cool. Of course, it's a great way of supporting us and our work. And you get an ad-free version of PCGamer.com. So
also handy.
Plenty of benefits. So yeah, if you got questions here, we'd love to hear from you. And yeah, I mean, just to sort of get us started and continue our previous conversation, like what would you guys say is the game that you're best at in your lifetime, either as a journalist or as a gamer, period? Like the game you had the most mastery over, your friends look to you for advice on, or you had the highest scores on?
I was decent at Pro Evolution Soccer for a while. Came second in like a press tournament. I won a press tournament for Hearthstone in Shanghai recently, but I wouldn't. Hearthstone's such a weird one. Like, I think I'm a decent player, but then if you know, it's Hearthstone. If you draw badly, you can lose to absolutely anyone. But I'm trying to think of like a game that I was mechanically really good at. I was struggling.
Like I said, I was halfway decent at Halo. Halo 2 and Halo 3 I was like reasonably competitive at, but I wasn't really any better than my friends, so we were mid-tier at best, those games.
Yeah, for me, I don't know. I mean, certain moments of playing Counter-Strike in the mid-2000s, probably. I'm like, trying to identify your prime is such a weird, tenuous thing.
You can't be sure when it was, but you know it's definitely gone.
It's something esports players are very cognizant of, right? Like, once they've hit 25, they're burned out. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, okay. So let's see. We got some questions coming in here from Buttface Jones, who is a PC Gamer Club member. How's it going? Compared to the 90s, do you think gamers today are more or less likely to prefer a game that is challenging? So is there kind of a greater taste or attraction to difficulty now versus the 90s?
I think the biggest problem with answering that question is just who was playing games and like what that audience is, because there's so many more people who play games now in so many more different ways, and I think games vary in so many ways compared to then. So like the question of the audience is kind of like impossible to put any kind of box around to begin with.
I think as well, like you go back to like games in the 90s, you might be like a side scrolling shoot 'em up or something, and it would only have like, you know, 10 levels. You by nature had to almost make it a bit harder, because otherwise you would just chew through it in like
30 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, you know, games these days with the budgets the big ones have got, they have to shoot for like as broad an audience as possible. But I think like one of the interesting things now is that like games which are very specifically challenging has almost become that can be a selling point. It's almost like a genre. Yeah, there's like a niche group of players who, you know, you see plenty of people streaming Cuphead because I think like there's something performative about it as well. Like, you're like, this guy's crazy good at it. Look how he's, you know, you see people like, going back to the games I play again, like soloing incredibly hard encounters that are designed for six people, and that because you can do it on Twitch and you put the video up and like, wow, that guy's crazy. So I think you're right, Wes. It's really changed because of the way the industry designs games and what the makeup of people who play games
I think
is.
The trend for like the most high profile stuff has taken that turn from up until, you know, people cite Dark Souls a lot and like games that have just aped its style, basically. But I think there was a trend up till that point of the big games that are aiming at the biggest possible audience moving away from the direction of being more challenging
and feeling a little bland and homogenized as a result. And Dark Souls definitely felt like a response to that.
Yeah, and then the success of that has let more people go, okay, I can make a game like this, and there is an audience for that. Yeah. And I don't think that audience ever went away. It was just like, it wasn't the most high profile thing that we were aware of.
It's also the rise of indie as well. We were talking on the Indie Channel about how, you know, the real flourishing of indie has really been in the last 10 years. And I think there's the scope there to go, all right, our niche is going to be a game that, you know, look at something like Super Meat Boy, right? It's like, or, you know, Binding Isaac, games that are like, mm-hmm. you know, potentially punishing, and that's their thing. It's almost like a chili challenge kind of thing, like how much can you take, can you do it, and you're kind of like, it becomes a water cooler moment as well. Then you're like, oh man, that boss, Jesus Christ.
It's a good point. I think digital distribution in general has allowed folks who want to make specific kind of games to directly find and keep their audience, right, and develop fans, as opposed to if you're competing for shelf space, you know, 10-15 years ago, it's much harder to do that. Yeah,
I don't even think like it was like, I can barely remember the 90s, but it wasn't like we were all like hanging out then going, oh man, loving these hard games, I wish they'd make some hard even harder games. It was just like what games were, like it was almost unconscious. It was just, you know, that was the design philosophy around a lot of stuff.
I mean, I vaguely remember the kind of chatter and rumors that would spawn of like, oh yeah, well my cousin or my uncle beat level 4 on Battletoads, you know, and like, you're like, whoa, that's crazy. and that kind of doesn't exist in the same way, right? But that's just, I think, the feeling of mystery that's been crushed almost entirely.
Don't you think it's
internet.
Been replaced by the kind of, I've 100% it in terms of like achievements,
the platinum trophy,
which is interesting because that is then a philosophical shift to comprehensiveness. I've absorbed all of the content, I've seen it and done it all.
Good point.
One of my favorite hard games in a totally different way of the past like 5 years was Fez, and I love that there were some communities out there that actually built like a specific environment for trying to replicate that schoolyard experience of sharing information and saying like, okay, we're not going to go out and we're not going to look at guides. We're not going to try to go online to other places and just find the solution to this really cryptic thing in the game. We're just going to chat with each other in small groups. And like, Fez is an incredibly easy game to play. Like, interacting with it is very, very simple. Figuring out what's going on with some of its more complex puzzles is incredibly complicated. And that's a that's an interesting style of difficulty that is kind of doesn't fit in this normal box of discussion of like what is a hard game. But I think it's really cool that people have come up with ways to retain that challenge and like that fun experience of discovery and sharing information with each other instead of just looking it up.
Max Urso wants to know, what games are so far out of your wheelhouse or individual wheelhouses that they have fallen overboard? So in other words, which games or genres are
do you just hate?
Or just like outside your expertise, like you wouldn't know what to do with them if you're handed to them. I think, I don't know, speaking for myself, we've all been doing this for a little while. I think when you're writing about games, you're naturally exposed to a wide variety of stuff. So I think most of us have played every type of game or reviewed or had something in our, you know, an appointment or a demo push into us that we had to take that we were unfamiliar with. I guess I'd say grand strategy stuff really baffles me. I tried a few times to play Crusader Kings 2, and I like history. I like reading history books. I like Civ. So I'm like, oh, this, I could do this. This makes sense. And the interface just crushes me every time. I know there, there's like great tutorials out there on YouTube. I just don't have the patience for that. I want immediate satisfaction. I'm a big FPS player. I want like, you know, 144 hertz everything responsiveness in my games. So
not nearly enough headshots in Crusader Kings.
No, but you can. There's a weird amount of, you know, intermarrying of let's say
probably like flight sims for me or something like it's kind of the same problem that you have in that like it's a degree of interacting with controls of some kind or like interfaces that's just really really complex. Like I'm sure I could figure out how to play a flight sim if I devoted enough time to it, but that's just a degree of like familiarizing yourself with 50 buttons on the keyboard and all of the UI equivalent on the dashboard of the plane that like does not interest me in putting that effort in.
I'd say a similar answer. Like I think I said this on the show before, but I tried to get into Stellaris twice. Like I heard Evan's good stories about it, and I love anything to do with space really, and the idea of being in space and having an empire seems sweet, but like once I got into the level of like you're like micromanaging the three levels of the planet, like the sort of the ground and the mid level and then the sky, and I was just like, I can't be doing this.
You should try Endless Space as kind of a more gateway 4X game. It's a bit easier to parse.
It's still a lot of input though.
Is it pretty?
I'd say pretty. The interface is prettier than Stellaris. Okay. Yeah. This sort of like rounder edges, so to speak. Mm. Cool. Good question. Damn good gamer. We just mentioned this. I heard that Neo is coming to PC. Are you excited or just meh? Wes, I'm looking at you.
I'm excited because I didn't play it on PlayStation, and I like games in the Dark Souls style, the Souls style, and this one is apparently a pretty shameless knockoff in terms of how it plays, but is apparently quite well done. So I'll definitely play that. I'm more excited just that it happened because I'm shocked because I thought Sony, in fact I know that Sony published it on the PS4, and I assumed that that meant they had some degree of involvement with funding the game, but I guess it was just like a timed exclusivity deal, and it's coming to PC. That's really rad.
Sony seems to be less aggressive about the PC than Nintendo. Obviously than they are with the Xbox. I know, like, because with isn't it with the Final Fantasy MMO you can have shared, you can share accounts, you can like move your character between PC?
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah. Because I know that that's what people were asking for with Destiny and then didn't get that kind of account sharing.
I think that might be on, it's because you have to have a bespoke like Final Fantasy 14 account, so it kind of doesn't matter where you're signing in, I think.
Yeah, they can definitely stop it happening though.
Yeah, Sony has actually published a game on Steam, which was Helldivers. That was a strange one made by the Magicka folks, I think. Like, if you look on Steam, it's actually published by Sony, which is weird. But.
Interesting. JBJ Blaze with a couple of questions. Anything yet on the Peace Gamer Club, including a free Twitch sub? That's definitely something we hope to add down the road, that kind of integration, but it requires some back-end work. So have to get back to you on that. But he also asks, on another note, with Cuphead having come out, what cartoons would you like to see adapted as a game? And what kind of game do you think it'd be? For me, I want to see another Full Metal Alchemist game, but with an RPG system, fleshed out combat, like Shadow Mortar, Batman Arkham.
That would be real cool. Along the anime weeb lines, I'll put in this show called Gurren Lagann. This is like the most over-the-top mech show fighting spirit ever that I think could be turned perfectly into a game by CyberConnect 2, who have made a bunch of Naruto games I've never played, but more importantly, they made Asura's Wrath, which is one of my favorite weird games of last gen. At one point, you like punch a planet so hard that it, I think you leave a dent in the planet or something. I don't know. It's all about like just insane gods
anime.
And like rage meters, and has really cool interplay between the actual interface of the game and what's happening in the cutscenes. And it's smarter than it looks.
That Dragon Ball Z game, what's it called? Looks pretty good.
Dragon Ball Fighter Z.
Looks nice. I don't like Dragon Ball at all, but it seems very loyal.
It's the perfect marriage of developer and material, like Arc System Works, who make like the Guilty Gear games, just like really complex anime fighting games. Doing a Dragon Ball game is a no-brainer.
Yeah. For me, I don't know. I guess I call out, okay, South Park's coming out really, really soon. Why
the
not
Fractured Butthole?
Why not a Simpsons RPG in the same style? I think that'd be delightful. Rick and Morty.
Wasn't there a Simpsons RPG?
There've been a lot of Simpsons games.
Yeah,
I feel like there was.
There was an open world game in like maybe that's 2010 or six or something. I don't know. Anyway, that'd be nice. Rick and Morty. There's a mobile game, I guess, where they add new characters every time there's a new episode. But
I don't really watch cartoons, but I would say I did watch recently Big Mouth on Netflix. Any of you seen that?
Big Mouth.
Yeah,
haven't heard of it.
It's really funny. It's like a kind of high school kids. Reek de Passage thing, but it's really, really filthy mouthed. It's very funny. I think it's on Netflix.
I think you could make great games out of practically, like in the style of Cuphead, just like a platformer or an adventure game out of cartoons dating back 100 years. You know, Felix the Cat could make a great cartoon. Like Looney Tunes probably could. You know, there were some fun like Looney Tunes platformers back in the 90s. But
Scooby-Doo was the first ever game I reviewed when I joined Future. I gave it like 6 out of 10, I think.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I remember that.
Was it worth it?
It's probably worse than 6. I was might be nervous.
All right, let's see if we can lightning round the last couple questions here. Has Muffins wants to know, if you had to suggest one game that came out in the last 3 months or will come out in the next 3 months, what would it be? So recommending something.
Oh, to buy?
Upcoming or that just came out recently.
I don't want to recommend it because I haven't played it, but I will be playing Shadow of Mordor, certainly. Our reviews should be going up.
Thursday? Tomorrow?
Tomorrow, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Check out Andy Kelly's verdict on that. I'll definitely play it, whatever. Otherwise, I would say, yeah, War of the Chosen is what I would recommend. I've loved it.
Yeah, for me, I've just had a blast with Quake Champions. I know we've been talking about it a lot over the past couple of weeks. It is the purest form of fast FPS. You know, it is the F1 racing of first-person shooters. So if you like super high skill ceilings, even if you don't, if you've stuck to Counter-Strike and that kind of like, you know, contemporary militaristic game, and you don't like energy weapons, you don't like hell as a theme, you know, it feels weird to you, just spend some time with it. I think you'll find something to like about Quake Champions.
Who doesn't like hell? It's the
night
theme.
Come on. Yeah. I'll go Divinity. It's easy. Divinity Original Sin 2. Play it.
What about coming up though, Wes?
That's a good question. I can't remember off the top of my head what. There's too many games coming out, and therefore I can remember none of them.
You just got Divinity Blind. That's all. There's no other games for you now.
That's fair. Yeah.
I didn't get to say it earlier, but the fact that Cuphead is $20 is a little surprising to me. I haven't finished it yet, but I think...
Surprisingly high?
Surprisingly low. Oh. I mean, I don't know.
Given my 20 seconds of playtime, it would have been surprisingly high.
I see. All right. There was one more here, if I can track it down. Okay, similar theme along the lines of difficulty. I'm glad that we're keeping these under a nice umbrella. Favis wants to know, which game annoyed you so much you've broken something? Mine was when I broke a joypad playing the last proper flat-out game, Flat-Out Ultimate Carnage.
Mm.
I can start. This would have been 2006 or something. I punched my laptop monitor playing Team Fortress Classic. I was playing in a clan at the time. I was in college.
Was this a really important match?
Literally in my parents' basement, you know? So endeavoring to be as cliche as possible. Ended up running that laptop with a monitor connected for the next several years and just being constantly reminded of my rage.
I don't think I've ever raged at a PC game, but I did in like 2002, well after the new generation of consoles had come out at the time, decide to go back and play Donkey Kong 64 for some reason. And I did the race against the like fucking beetle guy who was faster than you. And he beat me about 10 times. And on the 11th time, I was like well ahead of him, like skipping towards the finish line. And then he just zoomed past me at the last second.
Just from rubber banding?
Yeah, basically. And I just spiked the N64 controller into the ground and destroyed the destroyed the joystick in it, and never played that game again to this day.
Yeah, for me, it's like sports games I've done this the most with. Yeah. In like the early 2000s, I feel like sports games have the highest instance of bullshit. I know, Tim, you've played a lot of football games.
My friend and I, Simon, at university, we would play actual soccer on PlayStation, and we would like punch each other in the thigh as we were playing to try and put each other off. I have a good story, though, again, about a soccer game. Like, I was playing it on the Mega Drive, you call the Genesis if you're in America. I'd have been about 18, 19 years old at the time because I was working in a bar. And after we'd finished at the pub, we'd come back to mine, me and a few other chaps, order some pizza, and we would play sensible soccer on Mega Drive like through the night. We'd play a league. So we'd have like four or five teams, and we'd play literally till dawn. And I got
was
like...
Was this nightly? Or like on...
No, every now and then. Like, okay. We'd be dead otherwise. Because we were like hammered drunk. So it got to like... The sun was coming up and I like missed out on the league championship by some absolute nonsense. Like I got completely robbed by the computer. Like, because we would play against AI mostly unless we matched against each other. And like I was so angry, I got up and like booted the Mega Drive against the wall, which is obviously a stupid thing to do. What was really stupid though was... They didn't have like the licenses for the correct teams or players. So I had painstakingly, using a pad, edited the name and appearance, which was just basically hair and skin color, of every single player in the Premier League. And when I booted it against the wall, it wiped them all. It defaulted everything back to the original state. And I immediately sent all my friends out. And even though it was like 5 a.m., just started doing the editing again.
Oh my
and just
God.
Kept going. Because I knew that if I didn't do it straight away, I would never do it. And I would not be able to play with the real names.
Wow. You kicked a console so hard that it deleted its data.
Yeah. Seriously, amazing.
You erased
yeah.
the memory on the battery. Yeah. Wow.
Bad times.
I don't know if I can touch that, Tim. Well, if you have any stories of unique rage that corrupted a file, perhaps, I'd love to hear them over on our Discord channel where you can continue the conversation with us if you're a PC Gamer Club member. Tim and Wes, thanks a lot for joining us this week, guys. Thanks for your good questions. I like that we're continuing on that theme there of difficulty. I think it's an interesting conversation. Hopefully, we'll find some good excuses to come back to it this year. But until next week, we'll see you guys every Wednesday, of course, on Twitch here, twitch.tv/PCGamer. Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Pacific, or you can find us on iTunes or other podcast providers or on youtube.com/PCGamer. Thanks a lot for watching. We'll see you guys next week.
Play Divinity.
I only mentioned Hearthstone once.
That's pretty good.
That's not bad.
That's pretty good.